Dear listeners, Saidam, and welcome once more to our program on questions and answers. Today we bring you our next episode in that series. Over to the presenter, Professor G. Venkatraman, who would be dealing with all your doubts and clearing them too.
Loving Sairam and greeting from Prashanthi Nilayam. Welcome once more to this broadcast in the Q&A series, which I hope is of some use to you. Today, I hope to deal with three or four questions, all connected with what might be called the true purpose of life and what humans must do to realize this so-called true purpose of life. If you recall, this was the theme I started with, and there are still many questions in this slot before I can move on to some other topic. Let me first read out the questions I wish to consider today. They are as follows. Question 1. How can man have flaws when he is the spark of the divine? Question 2. Why does man forget God? How does man deceive himself? Question 3. Why is the cosmic aspect of man important? Question 4. How can man enter the cosmic route which would lead him to God? So these are the four questions I hope to deal with in my broadcast today. And let me see how far I am successful. By the way, I do hope you are able to see some kind of a connection between the four questions I read out just now. Let me start with the first question, which is, how can man have flaws when he is a spark of the divine? I am sure all of us know that humans are false, in fact plenty of them, but not many may be aware that we are sparks of the divine. So perhaps I should start with a brief remark on the latter point. If we look around, one thing we cannot escape seeing is bewildering diversity. No matter to which religious faith one belongs, or even if one does not believe in a God supreme, one thing that no one can deny is the incredible diversity with which the entire universe is packed. We have everything from rocks to gigantic mountains, from little streams to big rivers and vast oceans, living creatures from the invisible bacteria and the tiny ant to huge elephants, and so on. For centuries, man has always wanted to know from where came all this diversity. Today, science has a pretty good reply, at least in part. It says, and some of this can be found in our S2S series entitled Quest for Infinity, science says that all the diversity in creation came from one primordial event called the Big Bang that occurred about 13.8 billion years ago and which signaled the birth of our universe. At the instant of the Big Bang, there was just one something, call it cosmic soup if you will. Physicists would say that this cosmic soup was governed by a single unified field theory and all that. However, within 1 second, yes, just one small second, this grand unified force field split into four distinct ones that have ruled the universe ever since. Playing out in different ways, these forces led step by step to the formation of electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., which later, coming together in many different ways, formed atoms, from which came molecules, and so on. Thereafter, it was a story of aggregation in many different ways, leading to everything from stars and galaxies to ants and monkeys. Thus, we can truly say that even science accepts that from one came many. Of course, the debate is all about what exactly that entity I call one is. Meanwhile, there is one critical fact I should mention here, and maybe also stress. All our bodies are made up of atoms, and these atoms have a lineage going back almost to the beginning of our universe. Further, locked up in the recesses of the atom are all the four fundamental forces that have been ruling the universe almost since its birth. These four forces are the gravitational force, the strong force that holds protons and neutrons together in the atomic nuclei, the so-called weak force that governs radioactivity, and finally the electromagnetic force that binds atoms and molecules and is very much a part of the macro world. By the way, without radioactivity, we cannot have many forms of cancer therapy, the gamma camera that helps to diagnose many diseases, industrial radiography and so on. So radioactivity is not as useless as many seem to think. I hope I have said enough to convince you that though we might not be conscious of it, the forces of nature are in fact mirrored within us, indeed every single atom of our body. In that sense, all of us are truly cosmic creatures. This is very interesting and flattering, no doubt, but you will agree that we are, at least while alive, something much more than a bunch of atoms or even complex molecules. You have something more, something we all know exists, but not easily described, and that is the mysterious entity called life. Everyone accepts that life exists, including atheists, but few have been able to describe life satisfactorily, in scientific terms, that is. When it comes to issues related to life, consciousness and such other matters, one finds three kinds of scientists. One type says, I do not know what consciousness is, and scientifically I am not concerned with it. I personally believe that consciousness falls outside the realm of science, and therefore I prefer not to comment on it. This is the so-called uncommitted neutral group, if I may call it that. Then there are others who say, life is something that transcends space and time, and science as we know it relates to matters that are bound by space and time. Therefore, I believe science can never answer questions relating to life and consciousness. Perhaps only religion and spirituality can. Maybe life is a gift of God. The third group is very allergic to God and vehemently declares, and its cries have become shriller lately, it declares there is no God. God is just a concept invented by humans who are weaklings and want a crust to hold on. Just hang on for a while and science would have all the answers to the mysteries of life and consciousness without invoking any God. This is the atheist lobby speaking. I am mentioning all this to stress that when one declares that humans are a spark of the divine, it automatically assumes A, that God exists, B, humans came from God, that is to say God created humans, though maybe in an elaborate and evolutionary sort of way, and C, the power of God resides in humans. The statement that humans are a spark of the divine is meant to stress that not only have humans been created by God, but also that in His infinite mercy, God has packed humans with all kinds of capabilities, each of which is a reflection of the divine, in a way more than atoms and molecules alone are. By the way, they too are packed with the power of the divine in their own way. To cut a long story short, in the celebrated Gita, Krishna gives a brief glimpse of the different ways in which God's power functions within humans. Comments related to this are spread all over, but in the 10th chapter called the Vibhuti Yoga, there is an impressive collection. It is to stress that humans have been cast in the image of God, something which the Bible too records, that Swami almost invariably begins his discourses with the words, Prema Swarupalara, meaning embodiments of divine love. In earlier times it used to be Divyatma Swarupalara, which means embodiments of the divine Atma. Either way, there is a reminder that we are all nothing but the sparks of the divine. Sorry about that long intro, but it was needed to set the stage to answer the main part of the first question, which I shall rephrase as follows. If man is indeed a spark of the divine, then why does he not behave like God? Why does he, as he often seems to these days, behave more like the devil? How could such a thing happen? That is the essence of the first question. It's a very important question that we would be dealing with in great detail as we go along. But the short answer to this question is as follows, and it all revolves around action. The universe is full of action, and every entity acts. And by every entity, I mean inanimate entities like stars and planets, animate entities all the way from plants and ants through elephants, and finally human beings. Is there any difference in the way these different entities act? Sure there is. Inanimate entities act according to set rules, and these are the rules that we refer to as laws of nature. Science is all about discovering the laws of nature and explaining them if one can. Many such laws have been discovered, and a good many of them have also been explained. When it comes to living beings, except humans, they too have certain rules that they obey. They do so by what we call instinct, and so we say, instinct built in by nature governs the actions of animate beings, except humans of course. To put it differently, actions in the case of animals is hardwired. No one teaches them how to. They know what to do and how to do because they've been programmed to, so to say. Perhaps the programs are encoded in the genes itself. Let me now move on to man. To some extent, he too is programmed and hardwired. This is inevitable since humans have evolved from lower animal species. But in one very important respect, humans are very lucky in that God has blessed them with very superior and remarkable powers. The most important power is resident in what we call the mind. Thus, if man exhibits flaws, sometimes very serious one, in spite of being a spark of the divine, it is entirely because the mind tricks him into actions that constitute a blot on the innate divinity of humans. In fact, that is the central problem today. And I guess we would be dealing with it quite extensively later on. For the moment, the simple answer to the question I am dealing with is that man has been given a mind that gives him a freedom of choice. Thus, though he knows what he should do and must do, he may decide not to do what is best for him and society, and thus stands in denial of the divinity latent in him. In short, if man is not behaving like God, mind is the reason for that. Mind is the culprit. This leads me on to the next question, which is, why does man forget God? How does man deceive himself? The short answer to both questions is the mind. Once again, man forgets God on account of the mind. As someone said, the mind has infinite capacity to trick itself. In other words, man deceives himself through his mind. It is no surprise then that the issue of the mind, what it is and how to deal with it the right way, assumes great importance in Vedanta. I cannot deal with all that right now, but for the moment maybe I could say the following. If you recall, in my last talk I mentioned that a human being is a composite of three entities, namely, first the Atma, which is fundamental, and forms the core of the human personality. Then, a subtle mind, which is supposed to play a role subordinate to the Atma, and finally, the gross body. By the way, when I say the mind should be subordinate to the Atma, it means that the mind must take instructions and guidance from the Atma. Having received this guidance, the mind is then supposed to guide the senses and the body how they should act in the external world under various circumstances. In this scenario, the Atma is in the driving seat, and if this hierarchy, namely Atma first, mind next and body last, is maintained and always observed, then there are no problems whatsoever, spiritually that is. However, things do not always occur according to the script. Often, the mind is easily misled by the senses, which drag humans into actions that seemingly lead to pleasure and happiness, but end up plunging the person into trouble and misery. Although this happens again and again, and in fact has happened millions of times in history, most humans want to discover disaster all by themselves. And so, misled by the senses and misguided by the deluded mind, they ignore the voice of conscience or the voice of God speaking from within. And that is how they court disaster. And when they find out about it, it is often too late. Rather like the man who constantly defies warning, smokes heavily, and finally ends up with lung cancer, from which he has no escape. I now move on to the third question in the present series, which is, why is the cosmic aspect of man important? This is an important question and requires a long and elaborate answer. Obviously, I cannot do that now, but the issue would surely come up again, at which point I shall deal with it in greater detail. Basically, it all boils down to almost the very first thing Krishna told Arjuna, when he suddenly announced that he, namely Arjuna, was quitting and dropping out from the war between the Kauravas and Pandavas just as it was about to begin. Krishna then told Arjuna, "Arjuna, you are not the body but the eternal Atma. Let your atmic nature guide your actions rather than mere worldly considerations." Swami reminds us of the same thing by telling us, "You are not man but God." However, what happens almost always is that misguided by the senses, the mind falls for the false attractions of the world. It forgets to take orders from the Atma and help man to lead his life in the proper way. In short, man forgets his priorities. In particular, he becomes very easily selfish. On the other hand, in the Gita, Krishna very clearly reminds man, "You have a cosmic connection with every entity in creation. Behind this connection, there is an underlying balance. If you forget this connection, you would be engaging in actions that upset the delicate balance I have ordained. What would be the result? You would be in deep trouble." If you want one example that illustrates the point powerfully, it is climate change. Driven by extreme self-interest and desire to consume more and more, man has become addicted to fossil fuels, that is, oil and coal. In some way or the other, our major sources of energy today are fossil fuels. The more we burn them, the more we pollute the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. But who cares? Hardly a few. Most say, "I live in now. Who cares about what happens tomorrow? That's none of my concern." And why have we landed in such a dangerous situation? Because we have stopped to think and be in harmony with the cosmos. It is this indifference that is leading to the destruction of the forest, the extermination of the species one by one, disturbance to biodiversity and bioequilibrium, and so on. Ultimately, it's all because we are forgetting that it is the Atma within us that is supreme and not the body or the senses, which are quite transient. True, the body and the senses do form a part of us. But to which do we give the importance, to the master or the servant? When the obvious does not meet the eye and priorities are brushed aside, there can be problems for sure. If we do not want problems, then we cannot and must not ignore the cosmic aspect of ourselves. Once again, this is bound to come up later. I shall at that time, slowly and in bits and pieces, start telling you more so that this matter makes better sense. This brings me to the last of the four questions I intend to discuss today, and this question is, how can man enter the cosmic route which would lead him to God? I would put it this way. When we are born, God does put us on the cosmic route, and in fact gives each one of us a compass called conscience. All we have to do is to keep consulting that compass and following it. If we do that, we are well on the road to God. Okay, all that is fine. Man has now lost his way, and so what should he do? That really is the essence of the present question, and it's a fair one, I must say. Let me go back to this compass business. Let us say Man has the compass, but the glass is very dirty. As a result, he cannot clearly see which way the needle inside is pointing. Suppose the man wants to use the compass. What should he do? Obviously, he should clean the glass. In the same way, our moral compass within is not lost or misplaced, just that it is covered with a lot of muck. So, the first order of business is to remove the accumulated dirt. In spirituality, it is the mind that accumulates dirt, and it is the mind that must be cleaned up. In practical terms, one has to go through a drill of mind and sense control, even as one has to go through all kinds of exercise and diet control if one wants to bring down obesity. I shall not go into all that drill right now, especially as it might frighten many of you. But I shall offer you a very simple recipe. It's not an original one, and Swami gave it to us a long time ago. It simply calls for us to keep chanting the name of the Lord as often as we can, even as we are doing work that does not call for heavy concentration. All right, but what name to choose? A bhajan that we often sing gives the answer. It says, Jo naam chahe, wo naam bolo, prem se bolo, bhav se bolo. Chant that name that appeals to you, but when you chant, do so with love and deep feeling. Remember that one? So you see, chanting the name is not as tough as it might sound. Often when our boys travel together in a bus, they spend time singing bhajans. In Prashanti, when Sevadals move objects in tractors and trucks, they do so singing. You can, as you vacuum the house, sing bhajans, and so on. There is really no limit to what one can do, and it's so easy to. Oh yes, there are a few other things that one must do. But first, let us get started with 1, 2, 3. Then we shall take the other steps, 4, 5, 6, etc. Okay? Well, I think I have said enough for today. That's all for now, and I hope you were able to understand what I have tried to convey. All the best, and God bless. See you again next week. Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to our program on Questions and Answers with Professor G. Venkatraman conducting the session. We hope you like the program. Please do write to us with your comments and additional questions, if any. You may write to listener@radiosai.org with the subject line saying Questions and Answers. Thank you, Sai Ram.
Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Krishna Baba Bata
Rama Krishna Baba Bata
Rama Krishna Baba Guru Deva
Rama Krishna Baba Guru Deva
Hold me close to your home, never let me go.
Sai Baba,
Sai Baba,
Dear listener, we now bring you a special message from Professor G. Venkatraman, recorded on the 7th of July 2015, where he shares about the reorganization of RadioSci's ownership as well as its administrative and financial setup. Over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Those of you who are regular listeners of Radio Sai must undoubtedly be aware of my long association with Radio Sai. Indeed, there was a time when I was the sole broadcaster. Since then, we have come a long way to a point where I am now merely an occasional broadcaster. That is not because I have become less active, but because I had to manage a lot of other tasks. Lately, we had to face several challenges, all the way from constantly adapting to rapidly changing technologies, to grooming additional human resource and achieving both greater diversity as well as significantly enhanced outreach. Not many of you may be aware that behind the generic / brand name Radio Sai, there were really two teams. One team was a part of the Sri Sathya Sai Sadhana Trust, and the other team was a part of the Sri Sathya Sai Media Foundation. The former trust happens to be a religious trust, which is permitted to make and sell products, while the latter, being a charitable trust, is strictly prohibited from commercial activities of any kind. Historically, this bifurcation of Radio Sai occurred around 6 or 7 years ago. This is not the occasion to go into that history, but I must add that where Team Radio Sai is concerned, in spirit and in work, we always functioned as one team, calling ourselves back then as the Prashanti Digital Studio. No one gave us this name, but we chose it since that was convenient for sending and receiving postal messages. Coming now to the purpose of this particular broadcast, I should mention as a preliminary that for over a year I have been engaged in informal discussions with some of the members of the Sri Sathya Sai Central Trust. In large part, it had to do with the archives coming up. For the record, the Sri Sathya Sai archives is where all collection of not only audio recordings and old photos would be held in permanent storage, but also thousands of feet of films and thousands of videotapes. Most important of all, the archive would hold thousands of pages of original handwritten manuscripts of Bhagwan, a good many of which were found only recently. High-tech storage of archival material was not the only issue we discussed. I also discussed the sharing of this treasure with the wider world, in particular the message they contained. Dissemination of that message, we agreed, has now become more important than ever before, especially since the avatar has withdrawn his physical form. It is important to recall here that when Swami was physically with us, he not only lived his message, but also spoke extensively about the latter. Swami has on occasions pointed out that the Lord incarnated as Sri Krishna mainly to give a message. That message was given just once on the battlefield in Kurukshetra in the form of the famous Bhagavad Gita. In the Satya Sai avatar, however, Swami not only expanded the 700 slokas of the Gita into something like 1,000 discourses, but he also parsed many subtleties connected with Atma-jnana. And this Bhagavan did in a manner suited to address the numerous problems facing humanity presently. As if this was not enough, Swami also executed several amazing social welfare projects, most of which we know very little about. Let me explain what I mean by that. Speaking personally, I have, over the years, given talks and also done documentaries on the water projects, the hospitals, and so on. But then, when 2 months ago I entered the general hospital here for prolonged treatment of a severe foot problem, I realized how little I knew about the manner in which the hospital lives Swami's values. It was thrilling and also humbling to see how the workers in the hospital, and I mean not only the doctors but also the nurses, the people who manage the dietary, right down to the sweepers and helpers, how all these people live the spirit of Sai Seva. Not merely that, just yesterday I heard that they had dealt with 2 cases of snake bite. Few are aware that there are very few hospitals in India that handle snake bite cases, and Swami's General Hospital here in Puttaparthi is one of them. Did you know that? One more thing. A few days ago, I recorded a long conversation with Dr. Narasimhan, who is the guiding spirit of Swami's Mobile General Hospital. So stunned I was by all that Dr. Narasimhan told me that I decided then and there to work hard on making a short documentary on this incredible wonder on wheels. I can safely say that there is nothing like this anywhere in the whole world, because it is difficult to find a person so charged with Sai love and Sai compassion as Dr. Narasimhan. If I may advertise a bit, watch this space for a compelling story told in living color. And now for the real purpose of this special broadcast. As the result of extensive deliberations, which included the increased funding we now need, it was decided that Radio Sai would become Radio Sai Division and function as an independent unit of and receive its funding from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust, even as the various hospitals and schools do. Thus, on July 1st, the Sri Satya Sai Media Foundation ceased to exist, and the entire Prashanti Digital Studio team got absorbed into the Radio Sai Division of the Mother Trust established by Swami himself, namely, the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. By the way, this does not mean that we no longer need your support. Far from it. We would, as before, very much need your moral support, for because you out there are our biggest customer, shall I say. As for financial support, you can continue to donate as before, but please send your donations to the Central Trust. While doing so, you could, if you choose, indicate that you would like the amount to be spent to support Radio Sai. Money is like oxygen, and the Mother Trust can support many activities only if devotees appreciate that the onus of keeping Swami's various missions going rests on all of us, both those who are here and those who are outside, no matter where that so-called outside is. That is all I have for now. Next week I shall try and record a longer video version so that you get a clearer picture of what I have tried to communicate presently. Thank you for listening. Since this message is important, please pass it on to as many people as you know as possible. God bless and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, you were listening to a special message from Professor Jivankatraman, recorded on the 7th of July 2015, where he shared about the reorganization of Radio Sai's ownership as well as its administrative and financial setup. Thank you and Sai Ram.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Krishna, make me